Talk given Saturday, 8th November, 1980. In the Upanishadic teachings, there is one remarkable statement in the Upanishad which is called the Varaha Upanishad. I don't know why it was called Varaha, because Varaha means a boar. That's what it means. And it may be that it is associated with that epoch in the course of human history, which is known as the boar epoch of our development. And in that Upanishad, it is distinctly stated, without any equivocation, that the primordial creative energy, which in Upanishadic terms is named Brahman or Atma, and pure or absolute consciousness, please note, absolute consciousness, are an identity, and they are not two, but they are an identity. They are one and the same reality as such. And they are in the utterly blissful state, in ananda, as they would say. Now, this primordial creative energy is undifferentiated, and it differentiates by self constriction. It constricts itself, and thereby it gives rise to the process of manifestation. This self-restriction, of course, it's not explained. One can't explain a thing like that. And from the undifferentiated state, we therefore see a cosmos emerging through differentiation. At the same time, pure or absolute consciousness begins to proliferate. I use two different words to because I think they are applicable in they are rightly applicable to the two. The primordial creative energy differentiates, pure or absolute consciousness proliferates, and the two are together all the time, so that there is not a thing in the universe which hasn't consciousness involved in it, embedded in it in some form or other. Everything can come to consciousness, into consciousness. Now, this, of course, would not at all appeal to the ordinary logical, intellectual mind of your ordinary philosopher or intellectualist. But if one has sufficiently deep sensitivity, one will see that this is the kind of thing that could work as such. Now, the pure consciousness in its own self, in its own nature, manifests in functions in terms of infinity, eternity, and immortality. It has no beginning, it has no ending. And it functions in eternity, not in terms merely of timelessness or time. We must note that difference very, very carefully, because most philosophers of religion and most religious people talk of the experience of timelessness as the experience of eternity. That is not the experience of eternity. Because you, the person, experience timelessness. And that experience comes in the very, very deep states of meditation. It has a beginning. And then time stops as far as you as a conscious individual are concerned. But you re-emerge into time, because the needs of the body have to be fulfilled sooner or later. The Buddha, for instance, talks of 7 days and nights in this state of timelessness. timelessness perhaps may be regarded as a photograph or a shadow of eternity itself. So eternity is not identical with timelessness, and it is not the opposite of time. This we must clearly understand. It is not the opposite of time. Eternity subsumes both time and timelessness. Regard time as the rhythm of the living process of the universe. And as a rhythm, it does not obey the clock, just a mechanical tick-tock. You see? It is a rhythm. Now, that rhythm is embodied in everything in the universe. In the atom, it is embodied also in living creatures, in living beings. Our heartbeat, our pulse, the rhythmic flow of the bloodstream, and our breathing, and so forth. All that which indicates whether we are in a state of harmony and health, or whether we are not in a state of harmony and health. So if you regard time as the rhythm of the living process of the universe, you'll get a clearer conception of the true nature of time. And both time and timelessness are subsumed in eternity. They are, in a sense, contained in eternity. Eternity is not a box which contains these two. It's not like a box of oranges where you can take out the oranges separately and they have their separate identity. Time, timelessness, and eternity do not have separate identities as such. Time and timelessness sort of express at certain stages of our development, in certain conditions of our own awareness and consciousness, the nature of eternity as such. And it is the action of the activity of the primordial creative energy in eternity which releases cosmos out of the primordial chaos. Chaos not meaning disorder, please note that very carefully. That is a secondary meaning. The primary meaning of chaos, the Greek chaos, is a state of vibrant quiescence. There is no movement. And since there is no movement in that quiescence, there is no life in the biological sense functioning there. There is life in the sense of absolute existence. There is no difficulty in understanding, at least I hope there is no difficulty in understanding that. But once movement starts, you get that type of manifestation which undergoes birth, procedure, and death. And you get the whole thing moving like that. Now this absolute or pure consciousness is spoken of as chetana, and atma. Atma is the specific word for that. Now there is the limited state. Oh yes, in the universal state where there is no limitation, it is chit or chid atma, and it is also called by the Yogacharas and their philosophy, alaya vijnana. In the limited state, when differentiation sets in and a cosmos consisting of multitudinous separate entities as such, or apparently separate entities, comes into being, that consciousness is referred to as vijnana. Vijnana, the Pali vijnana, which means discriminative consciousness. Now, discriminative consciousness analyzes. And after analyzing, it synthesizes. All the impressions that come through the functioning of the senses and the impressions which they create are dissected by the discriminative consciousness, and then they are synthesized not integrated but synthesized, and therefore there emerge concepts and names, and Adam gave them names. That sort of thing happens. So this naming process and synthesizing process is one which establishes and maintains and preserves separation in consciousness. This is where the trouble first arises, this separateness. When we come to human nature, human beings, we are conscious in terms of an isolative self-consciousness, something which separates everything from everything else, and oneself, of course. And it is this separation of self and what is commonly called the not-self, the totality, which is the root source of all the misery and trouble in our lives, in human life. So it's called vijnana in Pali. It is called chetana or chetas in the Sanskrit, you see. That's the limited consciousness. Now, in manifestation, when differentiation has taken place, we are in the context of finitude. Everything is measurable. Everything is limited. We are in the context of finitude, temporality, and mortality. The moment you get the time factor interpreted by us as something which moves just in a straight line, like a river going towards the sea, then you are bound to have the beginning, the ending, birth and death. And this is the entire context of mortality. The whole of time is contained in the context of mortality, not of immortality. Time is not immortal. When we say, may you be happy forever and ever, or we should like this sort of thing to exist forever and ever, we are talking nonsense. It just doesn't happen that way. The context of the transcendent, out of which emerges all this separate cosmos as such, the separate items composing the cosmos, is the context of infinity. Now, when we use the word infinity, we immediately think in terms of bigness. But infinity means non-finite, that which is not limited, that which is not particular. You see, this is important to bear in mind, because infinity has two aspects. You take the point, a point. It has, you can't measure a point. It has no length, no breadth, no depth, no dimensions whatsoever. You cannot have any sort of point which you can get hold of materially, concretely. You can't get hold of it concretely. If you could, it has a definite size. Whether it has, if it's spherical, it has a radius. If it is an ordinary solid object, it has length, breadth, and depth. So that is not a point in the pure geometrical sense. This point in the pure sense is only conceptual. You can conceive of it. You can arbitrarily postulate it, talk of it. And that is one aspect of infinity. It's non-measurable, immeasurable. There is the other aspect, the aspect of bigness with which we are all familiar. It is so big that you can't measure it at all. And we say that it is infinite. There are no limitations to it and so forth. That is what we say. So now, there are these two contexts. Now, I say that there are two contexts, but that is not a completely accurate statement. The context of the transcendent, the context of infinity, eternity, and immortality completely subsumes the context of the finite, the temporal, and the mortal. Don't translate the word subsumes as contains, like a box which contains objects. It's not like that. This subsumption is a very extraordinary thing altogether. Let me go on, and then you'll see what emerges. Start with a point. You can't take an infinite number of points, put them side by side, and get a line. You can't do it materially, of course, but you can't do it even conceptually, because if you count points like that conceptually, there is a space, there is a gap between one point and the next point, even conceptually, so that you won't get a line, a straight line, by putting points side by side. But if a point conceptually were to move, the movement is a living activity. And it is that life activity, in the mind only, mind you, which produces a line. Now we say, oh, we see a straight line. We don't see a straight line. We see a surface, if you like. But we don't see a line. A line is invisible just as a point is invisible. Have you ever thought of that? The pure line as a line is really invisible. You can't see it. You can't touch it. When a point moves conceptually in your thought, it produces a line in thought. Now, make that line move at right angles to itself, you get a surface. You get a surface. Now, you won't see the surface at all. It will also be invisible unless and until that surface has moved at right angles to itself and produced a solid object. Then you can see everything, and you can understand the meaning of point, line, surface, and solid object. You see? This is one of the extraordinary things. But what has happened when a point has moved like that to form a line? The point itself belongs to the context of infinity. But the line is a finite thing which is measurable. It's a certain length. You see? Now, in the same way, the infinite number of lines which constitutes a surface is measurable, length and breadth, but it contains an infinitude of lines as such. You see what I'm getting at? And then you get the movement of the surface, and you get a solid object. You see? An infinity of surfaces, although each surface by itself is invisible, and it is measurable. As such, it is immeasurable. It makes up the measurable solid object. So now, the result of that, all that, is just this. The context of the infinite, eternal, and immortal is completely interwoven with the context of the finite, the temporal, and the mortal. This sort of penetration, I think, probably gave rise to statements like, in him we live and move and have our being. That is in the Christian formulation, and in the Upanishadic formulation, Brahman is the absolute all. And the yogi is able to say also, Aham Brahmasmi, I am Brahman. Now, what is the implication there? That which is finite exists in its finitude because in the infinite and the immortal has constrained itself, has restricted itself in order to manifest as the concrete and the finite. Is that fairly clear anyway? You see? So that the two contexts are completely inextricably interwoven with each other. Which means, if you like to use ordinary theistic language, divinity and that which exists as such anywhere, everywhere, is one and the same thing in actuality. You have often heard me say that transcendence is embodied in us. And that's a literal fact. It is embodied in us. I've presented it in this form because this is an intellectual, philosophical picture, if you like, of what one can realize, what you yourself can realize in innermost consciousness, if and when you can enter the profoundest meditative states. So, the question then arises, which way shall you or I move in consciousness whilst we are alive? The movement which is a movement of growth is always out of the finite, an emergence out of the finite and the mortal into the infinite and the immortal. So you see, the philosophical aspect of religion has a tremendous implication for all of us who are concerned with living the religious life, and for all of us who are concerned with yoga. The yogis discovered this kind of thing. But they didn't present it in the form in which I'm trying to present it, because the language in which things are presented depends upon the circumstance, the particular climate of thought and knowledge in which we live. In those days there wasn't that kind of climate of thought, so they didn't present it in this form. But this form gives us a much greater logical, intellectual grasp of it all. So you see, our growth, our fruition, our fulfillment has transcendence absolutely embodied in us, moving us without compelling us. This is the important thing. It moves us towards this fruition in terms of mind and consciousness. The movement takes place because one cares for it. If one doesn't care for it, there is no compulsion ever exercised by transcendence. No compulsion. God never compels. The devil tries to compel you by alluring you, by seducing you. But God never compels. Because God is absolute. I'm using the word God freely because it's a very convenient small word instead of using big words, you see. So this which is within us is what we have to tend. And the tending of this which is this transcendence which is within us is the living of the religious life in the full sense. Transcendence is imprisoned by its own act of self-constriction in order to produce the particular, innumerable particulars which compose the cosmos. It deliberately constricts itself. And you find it presented in, Christian teaching in terms of God incarnating and taking upon himself humanness and all the troubles and difficulties of humanity in the person of Jesus Christ. Jesus who became the Christ. It is in other religions too, but it's not put in that form. It is easiest for us to sort of look at it in this form because all of you, or most of you anyway, are born and brought up in a Christian milieu and a Christian culture. The psychical and the psycho-spiritual atmosphere in which we live is Christian, essentially. We can't get away from that. We shouldn't try to. If your parent left you a nice large fortune, do you try to run away from it? And as a matter of fact, the divine has left us a wonderful fortune, but we are not good capitalists nor good socialists. We are quite ignorant of how to use capital and what capital implies, and we are even worse off where our understanding of the word social is concerned. We are most unsocialistic right through the world. We are concerned with ourselves. We want, I want. When you get the I want, that's the end of being social. Us, the us consciousness has to function. So now, the divine limits itself and is in the state of imprisonment within our own psychophysical constitution. But it doesn't push us forward. It is our responsibility to wake up to that fact, really to wake up to it, and of our own free will and accord, use our senses in such a manner that we can truly see that that is the case. We don't use our senses properly. We think, we imagine we are sensible, but we are far from sensible people. This is one of the great tasks of the yogi. He has to train the psychophysical organism in such a manner that the senses function with the utmost intensity and purity. And that, of course, is associated with bodily action. All bodily action has to have the purity, the beauty, the goodness, which is associated with the whole concept of the divine or transcendence itself as such. That is our particular task. So the first task of the yogi or of the person who lives the religious life is to use his senses in the right manner. Now, this is not an easy thing to do, because things go awry rather naturally. Why do they go awry naturally? The organism, the psychophysical organism, has an animal descent. We are descended from an animal ancestor. And the animal ancestor has certain ingrained qualities which come out in us too, because this is an animal body. The things like fear, like jealousy, like anger and so forth, according to the particular situation in which the animal is, whether it is a situation of danger or whether it's a situation where it's a case of fighting for the mate or something like that comes into being. So you get all these qualities. And they are ingrained in the body as such. But that actually is a blessing, because those are the things which are the challenge, the stimulus given to us as possessed of human minds and human hearts to understand the whole thing and outgrow the ill state. We have to outgrow the ill state. People make the great mistake of trying to destroy evil, get rid of evil. You'll never destroy or get rid of evil. Utilize the evil, transform it. The evil exists as a fact. All right, it is there. What do I do with it? What do I do about it? I have to change it. The same thing happens where upbringing and education is concerned. This fellow is an awful little devil, give him a sound thrashing. Oh no, you'll make him a bigger devil. That's what happens. But if you really understand, you can draw out of him. Of course, it requires extraordinary ability and vision. You can draw out of him the hidden divinity, the imprisoned divinity. It can be drawn out. There may be cases where it is quite impossible. simply because the organism itself is so diseased, say, brain-wise or something or other, there is nothing to bring out. I mean, you just can't do it. Transcendence has to have a concrete apparatus through which to function. We must never forget that. You see? So, whatever it is, we have to utilize it in the right way. And then you can purify it and bring out what needs to be brought out. If we understand all this, we will understand why, for example, in Buddhism, in Mahayana Buddhism, it is taught that nirvana and samsara are an identity. I think this sort of presentation will help you to sort of grasp the idea as such. Now, if we can see that, we will also see that the relative and the absolute are an identity. But the absolute is a one only. It is the alone, the supreme alone. The one alone. And if you look into your Patanjali sutras, you will see how the whole work ends, that the yogi has realized the state of Kevala, the completely alone. That doesn't mean cut away from or separate from, but he has become the one only, which means that in mind and consciousness there is the complete unification with the totality. You see, this is the important point to bear in mind. Now, of course, the question gets asked, well, what do I do? How do I set about it? Well, perhaps I could suggest, just be quiet, do nothing. What can I do? Everyone wants to know what he can do. All right, you tell him something which involves a procedure, a technique. That man has his own defects, his good qualities as well as his bad qualities. He is in the state of duality, in the state of conflict and confusion. All his flaws and his faults will be flies in the ointment which he makes. So just stop doing. Be quiet and observant. Just observe and observe. The observation in the beginning will of course be tainted, because you will find, if you really practice this throughout the day, watch yourself carefully, you will see that every observation gets related to the isolative I consciousness, I am I. And you will be thinking in terms of what is beneficial, what is good for you, what advances you, what brings you good results, good being defined by you, the imperfect one, you see, and so forth. So it's a devil of a mess. But persevere in quiet observation and watch all the chatter that the brain will throw back, I would almost like to say, will bark back at every single sense impression. And then gradually, when you really see all that and see how it all works and stay with it quietly, just stay with it. Don't try to get rid of the evil. Don't try to increase the pleasant. Get free of the opposites. This is true yoga. The complete freedom from all attachments and aversions. And this is not at all easy, because the process in the human psyche is so complex and so troublesome and so difficult. But by patience, with patience and with quietness, you will begin to see light, you'll see truth. You know how in the Rig Veda they talked, or perhaps you don't know how in the Rig Veda they talked about the various gods. Agni, the god of fire, Surya, the god of light, the sun. First meaning of Surya is the sun, which we see in the we see shining. You see, not today, but on other days. Surya, light. Now Surya has another aspect, Mitra, who shines by night. And we have a third aspect presented of this light, Savitri, who shines by day and night. Now, Agni, Surya, Mitra and Savitri are all within yourself. They are ways of talking about your own self and what happens to your own mind and consciousness as you live the religious life in the true sense, or the yogic life in the true sense, and let this light gradually emerge. The divine never compels, but divinity, if you just send a charming invitation to divinity and keep your door open, divinity will come in and completely flood your whole being. Then you will know what true happiness and true fulfillment is. And it will enlighten you. And it will enlighten you not merely as so many conceptions or thoughts. They will all be out. But mind will begin to function in you for the first time. We all think that we have minds. We haven't. We have merely a vast collection of mental constructs. Our particular thoughts, our particular concepts, our particular ideas and convictions, and worst of all, our beliefs. We are incorrigibly attached to our beliefs as such. What grounds have we for this, that or the other belief? Look at any belief and see whether it is in line with truth, with reality, or whether it is something which is just temporal, which is passing, and which more often than not is harmful to oneself as well as to one's environment. Now it is important to understand all this and see our way through this veil of darkness and tears. And when I say that you get enlightened, it is not only it is not only that mind, which is a universal energy, begins to function through your purified psyche, but the very cells of the brain and the body undergo transformation. They undergo transformation. And that is actually just quite recently beginning to be investigated and seen by scientists. That, you know, we were always taught that the brain cells die at least 10,000 per day. And we have 10,000 million brain cells approximately. So that if we were to live to a million days, we'd be nice brainless animals. you see, this would be just an empty pot turned upside down. But the brain cells can regenerate themselves. That is beginning to be known now. And the living of the religious life in the full sense, and especially when you are able in the deep meditative states to realize that state of complete silence and what the world would call complete inactivity, which actually is a state of perfect harmlessness. When you are in that state, then the brain cells become rejuvenated. They don't die off. That's the extraordinary part of it. Then there is that other phenomenon which we mentioned yesterday. The transfiguration of the body itself. It is said of the Buddha, it is said of Zarathustra, it is said of Sri Krishna, and it is said of Jesus. The transfiguration takes place, and the whole psychophysical being appears to shine. And also in the case of Moses, when he came down from the mount where he was for 40 days and nights, talking with the Lord face to face as a friend talks to a friend. And it's rather interesting. I think it's in the Gita too. This Sri Krishna talking to Arjuna, it's presented as a friend talking to a friend. And so it's a wonderful thing. That transfiguration takes place. And then, of course, there is the full fruition of the person as the perfected Holy One, the true human being as such. Now, just one last word. We come back to this thing, subsumes and the subsumption. By the self-restriction of divinity, the imprisonment of divinity, this concrete manifestation appears. And this concrete manifestation belongs to this context of the finite, the temporal, and the mortal. But because of the fact that there is this absolute completely embodied in us as such, it is that, because that has the primordial creative power in it, it is because of that that it is always the movement out of the finite into the infinite, out of the temporal into the eternal, out of the mortal into the immortal. Now, human destiny is an extraordinary thing. One can't begin to talk about the wonder, the beauty, the marvel, the transcendent quality of this thing. And that is our real heritage and the fulfillment to which we are moved all the time, if only we could see and understand. Thank you.